with them. And as a society, they have a problem getting the next generation involved.
When I look at the panel, descendants of Confederate,
there is also a void in the next generation. In looking at ourselves and my generation and some of my children's generation, but none of their children, we all know or knew Holocaust survivors. Our African American friends up here either knew who their grandparents, aunts and uncles, people who were born or lived in slavery. The future generation don't. And it's a problem. But recently, the tragedy in Southern Florida with the shooting, the success of young students to come up and stand up and face the problem. And we talked about it, just come for a second. Vote them out. Register and vote. And that's all politically I have to say. I would like to introduce our second chair, Monuments America Square. Ken Rosengarten, a longtime friend of mine, who I knew when our children were growing up in soccer, and more recently through the society, is the Zucker Goldberg Chair of Holocaust Studies at the College of Charleston. He received a BA from Amherst College and a PhD in History of American Civilization from Harvard. While his primary field of research and writing is African American history, he has been a student of the Holocaust for more than 50 years. He teaches courses on the subject at the College of Charleston and the Honors College at the University of South Carolina. He directs workshops for middle and high school teachers, and most importantly, what I was talking about, leads semi-annual study trips abroad to Poland and Germany for students. That's important, really important. I turn this over to Ken, who will introduce the panel.
Great, thanks. Work. Thanks.
Yeah,
okay.
You have to keep holding for life.
He has a PhD and he's got it. Okay. Working? No. Okay. This will be a self timer. If when your finger gets tired, stop talking. Well, it's a beautiful day. And I wish we were all out in Marion Square. That would really be a great place to have this discussion. I was reading, actually in the past week, some journals of plantation owners, 19th century plantation owners, who were talking about what they were doing right now at this time, kind of the end of April, beginning toward the beginning of May. And their enslaved workers are in the fields hoeing peas and potatoes and corn, the rice and cotton coming up, and they're looking and anticipating kind of wonderful crops. And when I walk through Marion Square and I think of those are the people who made the wealth that built this city. They built kind of the environment the built environment anyway, and yet there's not a word in that field of monuments, scarcely a plaque. To the people whose constructive activity puts us all here, really, today. Well, as Jeff said, my name is Ted Rosengarten, and I have been really, in some way, collecting materials on African American history and kind of modern Jewish history, particularly the Holocaust, since I'm a little child, since before there was a word Holocaust, since that word really comes into the language in the late 1950s, early 1960s. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to introduce my two friends to my left here. Each of them will speak for a little while, I think, on the meaning of the monuments today, and what they meant to the people who established them and the meaning to them today. I'll probably, I will in fact, reserve a little bit of their time to own in on my own kind of a background in this. But first, let me say who's with me. I have here on my left Christine King Mitchell, who is the interpreter, the historical interpreter at the Slave Mart Museum in Charleston. And I should say right now, at the very start, that all three of us are commoners. None of us was born in Charleston, although we have connections to Charleston, and some, for example, in the case of Michael's connections, they really go back to 1700 and the period in Charleston. And none of us here, none of the three of us, advocates taking down monuments, or taking down the monuments that are in Marion Square, but we do advocate certain changes to the situation there. And to Christine's left is Michael Kogan, a dear friend. Michael is a professor emeritus of religion at Montclair State University. He has also taught philosophy courses at the College of Charleston for numbers of years. He is a pillar of the organization that has brought us here today, the South Carolina Jewish Historical Society. And he is a member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, an organization made up of descendants of Confederate soldiers. And I think I will just reserve just a few minutes to say, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, that great reservoir of kind of Southern historians. I think Southern Jewish historians. I think of Herbert Gutman and just Leon Littlack, Levine, just as a whole line of us. I grew up in an area where, in the very place I grew up, in the late 1940s, there were great things happening. The first was that this amazing man named Jackie Robinson was integrating baseball about three blocks from where we lived and integrating the United States. It was just knocking down kind of the barriers to the participation of black people in public life. And the second thing, which was so exciting to me, is that there was a huge influx into the neighborhood of people who had just come from Europe. They were called refugees. We didn't have a word surviving yet. They were called refs, and they were called some things which also weren't so nice, even by kind of Jewish people, including my parents. I can remember on Friday nights, you hear some of this commotion. You didn't know what was happening. Was Jackie Robinson hit a home run over there in Ebbets Field, or were people reliving their kind of nightmares in the building at this time? I remember we lived also close to Prospect Park and to the great soldiers and sailors arch, the monument, Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn, which was a monument to the Union soldiers, and a monument as well to Abraham Lincoln and to Ulysses S. Grant, who had kind of equestrian statues of themselves embedded in those monuments. And for me, studying the history of the Holocaust and studying the history of African Americans in America were always linked. I never felt. And when years ago people would say, well, why are you doing this? And you've left African American studies and you're studying now the Holocaust, or you're studying the Holocaust and you're not studying African American studies. These days, in the climate of today, they've come together. And I'm not asked that question anymore, I have to say. All right, so let me start, and I'd like to start not with Christine, but with Michael. And we'll ask Michael to give us his opening remarks. Michael.
Good afternoon. Delighted to be here. What kind of a microphone is this? I've got to keep my finger on it?
Keep your finger.
Keep your finger on it.
I mean, who designed this? As some of you know, my field and my writings are in the field of Jewish-Christian reconciliation after 2,000 years of mutual hostility. And my book, Opening the Covenant, A Jewish Theology of Christianity, documents the history of Jewish-Christian relations since 1965 in the Second Vatican Council the Christian churches, most of them, have done a 180-degree turn in their attitude toward Jews. They no longer claim to have replaced the Jews as God's people, but to have joined the Jews. Since the covenant God made between himself and our people, they now say is eternal. God doesn't change his mind. An extraordinary turn. And now, I would say, in New Jersey, where I taught for 42 years, there are more Holocaust remembrance services in Catholic churches than there are in synagogues. They're doing everything they can possibly do because they realize their anti-Semitic teachings over 2,000 years helped to enable Hitler. And they're doing penance for that. And it's a beautiful thing to see. And we have to come to recognize it. And my book is an attempt to extend the Jewish hand from our side to embrace the hand that they have offered to us. Now, why do I talk about this? Because my whole career is based upon creating brotherhood and sisterhood between peoples who have been enemies. Reconciliation. And that brings me here today. We have a situation, I remember, I'm certainly old enough to remember, the 100th anniversary of the war between the states. And I lived in New York. How did a Charleston kid, as I was, get to New York? And we lived here from 1700 until 1873. As some of you know, after the war between the states, there was a Yankee occupation of this city with blue-coated soldiers with guns walking around the streets. And it was 11 years of what we viewed as a foreign occupation. After most of that, my great-great-great-grandfather, who was the founding rabbi of Brit Shalom, which is now BSBI on Rutledge Avenue, took the family to Baltimore. I guess he thought if you can't beat the Yankees, you join them. And he went to Baltimore where he could earn a living as a rabbi and get away from the occupation. And then his granddaughter, my great-grandmother, met a Yankee from New York, married him, and moved to Manhattan. So that's how my grandmother and my mother and I were born in Manhattan. That place across the river from Brooklyn. My mother was for 40 years an officer of the Daughters of the Confederacy, which is the organization of female descendants of Confederate soldiers. And she enrolled me when I was 10 in the Children of the Confederacy. And then when I was 15, I was transferred to the Sons of Confederate Veterans, the organization of male descendants of Confederate soldiers. And ultimately, I became the commander of the Sons of Confederate Veterans in New York. And with a good friend, with the commander of the Sons of Union Veterans, and on the 100th anniversary of the war, we all got together. And we had church services together in memory of the dead on both sides. We met at Grant's tomb. Did you know that Mrs. Jefferson Davis, our president's widow, was the guest of honor at the opening of Grant's tomb? Grant was friendly to the South, as you know, and he and General Lee were intimate friends, but he gave us great terms at the end of the war and generally always spoke highly of Grant and Grant of Lee. So we had ceremonies in the morning on General Grant's birthday at the tomb in New York, and they invited me to speak. The Sons of Union Veterans wanted to hear from me, and I spoke. And I gave a talk some years ago, which I've just seen on YouTube. I didn't know anybody. Be careful, you're being YouTubed. I didn't know anybody recorded it. And what I said, but it got a standing ovation in that tomb, I said to the Yankees there, your ancestors fought for the preservation of their beloved Union, and that was an honorable cause. And our ancestors fought that the flag of a southern nation might fly among the banners of the world, and that was an honorable cause. But it is not the causes that bring us together today, it is the honor, the shared honor. And they rose and cheered, because in those days, everyone respected everyone. The soldiers, descendants of the Yankee soldiers, respected us as descendants of Confederate soldiers, and vice versa. We marched together in Memorial Day parades, and we flew our flags, and my mother would always have receptions. She had one of these vast Manhattan apartments on Park Avenue, and she could fit 200 people in there. And after our joint exercises at the tomb or at the church, We would all go to her house for tea and bourbon. And she would stand at the door, and the first time a Yankee reenactor in a blue uniform would come in, she'd say, "Yankees in terror! Who let them in?" So, I was raised, it's in my DNA, as my being Jewish is, and not as my being American is. I was raised with this whole great Southern mythos of the glorious lost cause. Glorious because we lost. But our president, Jefferson Davis, quoted Marcus Aurelius, "Defeat nobly born is victory." And I was raised on this since I was 10 years old, at least. And in fact, my teacher in seventh grade, and I discovered this only after my mother passed away and I was looking through her papers, that teacher sent a letter to my mother in 1950-something. And she said, "There's something wrong with Michael." Well, I'm anything. One thing, because when his friends go out to play in the yard at intermission, what do you call it?
Recess.
I've been away from school long. And at recess, he sits at his desk reading biographies of Confederate generals, one after another after another. And my mother wrote back, "Dear Yankee." So although I was a New Yorker, I was raised on the notion that I was a South Carolinian, a Charlestonian, especially in exile. And when I began to come down here, I found the graves of all my ancestors in Cumming Street, where I will join them eventually, and in the Jewish, the Orthodox cemetery near Magnolia. And I know every house they lived in. It's an extraordinary experience to return home in that sense. And now, of course, I've been coming here since 1980 for much of the year, and now I have a home here. And as the Charleston lady said when they said, "Have you traveled?" She said, "Why should I? I'm already here." One more anecdote. My grandmother used to serve the most wonderful bread pudding, and it was soaked in bourbon. And every time she served it, she would explain that, she said, "My grandmother, my great-great-grandmother, told me the stories about the poverty and deprivation during the 11 years of Yankee occupation. We couldn't afford fresh bread. And we had been wealthy. We had a plantation in Abbeville, and we lost everything. And everyone was starving, black and white. And she took us to the market, where it is today, and bought three-day-old bread. And she said the only way it could be made edible was to soak it down and cover it in this fine Southern bourbon." And I heard that story 1,000 times. And finally I said, "Gaga," which is a kind of Southernism for grandma, "Gaga, if we couldn't afford fresh bread, how could we afford that fine Southern bourbon?" And she said, "Darling, every family has its priorities." She was quite a character. Somebody once said, "Mrs. Sinkoff, don't you think that Sherman burned Columbia and our house on Assembly Street with it?" And they said, "Don't you think that it's time to forgive General Sherman?" And she said, "Darling, I'm not just a Southerner, I'm a Southern Jew. We haven't forgiven Pharaoh in 1300 BC. You think I'm going to forgive General Sherman?" So I was raised on all this. When Sherman came to Columbia, it was a Friday, and my Orthodox family was having a Sabbath meal in the Assembly Street house, and all the silver was on the table. And the meal was served by the nurse of the children who was there taking care of the kids. And they had a Sabbath meal, and then there was a knock on the door. It was three Yankee officers. They'd never seen Yankees. How did they get here? They didn't know Sherman had invaded the town. And they invited them to dinner. They were terrified. They gave them a beautiful dinner. And at the end of the meal, one of the officers said, "You have 15 minutes to get out of this house. We have orders to burn this block." Everyone panicked, except the servant who had been serving the meal. She took all of the silver from the table and everything she should get from the cabinets, took off one of her many skirts, wrapped it all up, and dropped it down the well. And they lived on that silver the income from selling it piece by piece for 11 years of Yankee occupation, except for the two Sabbath candlesticks, which I have on my table in my home on the Battery. And that's my connection to this. I was born to it. And last September, I went to the monthly meeting of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, which is mainly it's a social club where we fried chicken and bourbon and fried chicken. And they were chattering about, we own Castle Pinckney, an island with a fortress in it, in the harbor. And we're clearing it up and restoring it, the great project. And they were talking about how wonderful it is that pelicans are roosting at Castle Pinckney. And we're going to have scientists count the pelicans and blah, blah. And I asked for the floor from the commander, and I got up and I said, I don't give a damn about pelicans or penguins or whatever the hell is out there. We are now challenged by the last battle of the war between the states. Our organization was tasked by General Stephen D. Lee in 1896 to preserve the honor of the Confederate soldier, not to defend the Confederacy or any political cause, but to preserve the honor of the Confederate soldier. And statues of those boys, and most of them were boys, who fought in the war are being desecrated and vandalized and torn down across the South. These boys did not fight for slavery. They knew nothing about it. 97% of them had no slaves. They fought because their home was invaded by a foreign army. There were many causes for secession. Slavery among them, tariffs, the natural conflict between an agrarian region and an industrializing region, all kinds of conflicts that led to secession. But there was only one cause for the war, and that was Lincoln's refusal to allow the 11 seceding states to go in peace, as Horace Greeley advised him to do, let the erring sisters go in peace. We believe that under the 10th Amendment, we have the right to secede. I believe that. I think the Southern cause was a constitutionally correct cause. The 10th Amendment says those powers not specifically given to the central government are reserved to the states and to the people. There's no mention that this union, which remember the states existed, 13 states, sovereign states existed before the union. They created the union for their mutual protection with the understanding that if it did not offer the mutual protection, they could withdraw. And when the Constitution was ratified by New York State, Rhode Island, and Virginia, they actually put in their ratification the right to withdraw when they wanted to. In other words, it says that the powers of the federal government can be reassumed by the people of the states at their will if something unconstitutional was going on in Washington. And they did it. And in my opinion, it was constitutional. So the cause was, in my view, a just one. But whether it was or not, the point is that the boys who fought for it deserve the same honor that the soldiers on the other side have. We are experiencing what I would call a war of the perfect against the good. All these boys were good. They fought for their country as they understood it. Robert E. Lee freed the slaves he inherited. He didn't believe in slavery. He said it was an abomination. And he violated the laws of Virginia by setting up, he knew he was going to free his slaves in a few years that he had inherited from his father-in-law. And he set up a school at Arlington Plantation and at White House Plantation, which he owned, to educate the slaves to read and write and deal with numbers before they were free. That was against the law in Virginia, but he did it anyway. And when they were free, he tried to get them jobs on the railroad. We have all kinds of letters of his saying, let's get a job for this one and that one and provide for them. Very humane man. But his statue was attacked in Charlottesville, of course, and now it was covered in the tarpaulin, and now a judge fortunately said take the tarpaulin off. People have a right to see it. This man, in my opinion, was the great American of the 19th century. His statues are being attacked. And yet, my recent visit to New York for my aunt's 102nd birthday, she was the first woman vice president of Temple Emanuel in New York. She'd made history in Reform Judaism. And my visit there, our club is right next to the Plaza Hotel, and there stands the statue, gold-plated now, of the war criminal General Sherman. who burned up, and yet General Lee's statue is not allowed. Let me just conclude by saying, what kind of a person, you know, I get to tell stories, and I enjoy that more than arguing. What kind of a man would I be if I sat by while the statues of my ancestors, some of whom died in that war, one at the age of 18 years old, in the charge of defending Virginia. What kind of a man would I be if I didn't do everything I could to oppose the desecration of these statues? And as was predicted, it's not only Confederate monuments that are attacked. Jefferson's statue has been vandalized at the University of Virginia, which he founded. Lincoln's statue was desecrated a few weeks ago because he wanted to send black folk back to Liberia at one point. Where does it end? Washington, Madison, Jefferson, they gave us our country, but they were slave owners. So wipe them out, pretend they never existed. If the people who founded this country, those great men, are villains, then the country is villainous. And if we allow this to happen, the nation that defeated the Soviets and defeated the Nazis will have devoured itself, and our people's belief in the goodness of this country will be destroyed. We're devouring ourselves, and this has to stop. It's a form of madness, and our organization has won in Charleston. So far, the statues haven't been touched. The so-called interpretive plaques have been shelved for a year because they weren't interpretations. They were attacks on the statues. And we've won so far, and we intend to continue to bring as much pressure on the city government as we can to keep those statues undefiled as they have been for all these years. They attack nobody, but they memorialize people of my blood who fought to defend this town, and they deserve to be honored. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Thank you, Michael. Very good. Christine?
All right. Finally, it's my time. I don't mean anything derogatory toward that. Michael and I had spoken outside, so I knew his feelings already. And we talked, and my personal feelings, and many may not agree, I don't have a problem with the statues themselves. I understand the history, the meaning behind them. But what I do have a problem with is there is not enough about the people that built all of this. The ones that died, that worked for free, that died for all of this. And when I walk around Charleston looking at all the beautiful homes, the hands that touch, the architects were from Europe, that's true. But the hands that actually laid the beautiful wood floors, the plaster design work, made the bricks that literally have their fingerprints left in them today, were people of African descent. And for them and their story not to be told on the same platform, on the same landscape where Calhoun and many others are, for me is a travesty. The whole story of American history, the whole story. But first, I want to share with you where I work. I'm on staff at the Old Slave Mart Museum on Charmer Street. I've been there for 5 years. My research and interest started there with the buying and selling of people of African descent. Literally buying human beings in downtown Charleston. On the streets, at the old courthouse, at the old exchange, at the corner of State and Chalmers, literally anywhere, Vendu Range, what's now Waterfront Park, used to be wharfs where people were bought and sold. And that's the story I've researched, I've studied, and it's given me a more profound history of understanding American history, because of what happened in Charleston and what I've learned. And I get to share that story on a daily basis with people from all over the world. Couple of things that that Michael mentioned, and I'd like to, one of the things you mentioned, respect. You mentioned respect for your ancestors. My ancestors never got respect. They never got anything. You mentioned where your ancestors are buried. We don't know where our ancestors are buried because they weren't even thought of or cared about enough to have actual graves with headstones to the word you use to honor them. There is no honor. As I have learned about John C. Calhoun, one of the things I learned is how he hated black people. Literally, the word hated. And then I started to learn, and I made some notes, of all the statues around the country that honor him. There are memorials, statues, schools, highways, streets, cities, city names that are named Calhoun. His name reigns in 31 states in the United States of America. And we are today talking about Marion Square statue, where he is. When I came here and as I learned the history, I had no personal reason to even go to Marion Square because there's nothing there for me. There's still nothing there. I walk by there on the sidewalks. But there is no history there for me to go and honor. And that's the part I would like to see more of. In the state of South Carolina, there are over 1,500 memorials, statues, markers to honor majority people of European descent. A lot of it because of the Civil War. There are many schools, there are schools named plaques with for blacks, but the majority of that 1,500 plus, it's not about people that look like me. The foundation of this country was literally built on the backs of free labor. And to not honor them, I feel that we as a people of African descent are still in the shadows of freedom. Freedom has still not come to us. And with the attitudes of people like you and your group, it never will, because you're still fighting. You're still fighting. How can people come together when you're still fighting? Fighting for a cause that, in your words, was not about slavery. But how could it not be when that was the way of life, that was the money, that was the banking system, that was the insurance system, that was the railroad system, it was the shipping business. It meant everything. That was the rice, the cotton, the tobacco, the bricks, the lumber. Human machines, all working for someone else, to build that honor of someone else. And this is now over 150 years ago, and we are still, as people of African descent, not free. And it saddens me. It saddened me for a moment to sit and listen to the words even though, as I said, I do understand both sides, and I still agree that the statutes, for learning purposes, for educational purposes, should be there. Because 100 years from now, if you take them all away, that history can be forgotten. But if right beside John C. Calhoun, let's tell the story of the plantation life and the tens of hundreds of enslaved people he owned and the works that they did up at Fort Hill Plantation, and talk about his family and Clemson University. Tell the whole story of John C. Calhoun. Not just put him on this monument that's so high in the sky, I can't even see it anyway. And nobody else can. So if there's a plaque put there, put the whole story. Some slave ancestors need to be literally, when I think about all the various places people were bought and sold, that could be a monumental plaque on every corner in downtown Charleston. In 1855, there were 260 slave trader offices in downtown Charleston. I have documentation. I've got names and addresses where their offices were. By 1859, there were 287. The decade of the 1850s were a moneymaker for everybody, not just in Charleston, but in this country as a whole, because of the buying and selling of people of African descent and the money made off of the backs of them. The Bank of Charleston was founded on slave mortgages and many other banks here. Insurance companies, everybody. These streets literally flow with the blood and the money today of people of African descent because of slavery. One other thing you mentioned was the ceremonies and at the grave sites. And some of the information I found in pensions, Confederate pensions, it was interesting that African Americans, the ones that were considered the personal servants, the cooks, those were the ones that were even considered to get a Confederate pension. Not until the 1920s. And so all the black men that built the fortifications like Fort Sumter, made the bricks, laying railroad tracks, building bridges, all the other works, even the ones doctoring on the sick ones and nursing the sick ones and burying the dead soldiers, were not considered for pensions by the Confederacy. So just a handful received even pensions. I thought that was interesting. The Confederacy allowed $3,000 for those young men. The Confederate soldiers were allowed $750,000. Pension. And during the time that they allowed pensions for the black ones, they didn't even make it up to giving them $3,000. It was $2,800. I urge and encourage everybody in this room to learn the whole story of American history. And then you will understand why there should be more plaques, statues, monuments, memorials dedicated to slavery, not just in Charleston, but in this country as a whole, to tell the whole story. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine. Michael and I disagree on a few things, but we also agree on some things. And though I'm the moderator, I want to just throw in 2 cents. My two sons attended public school in McClellan, up the road, 40 miles away. And the principal of that school would never send students on trips to Columbia. She wouldn't go to Columbia as long as the Confederate flag flew. Her name was Juanita Middleton, a great African-American educator. And she didn't want him going anywhere near Marion Square either in Charleston. And she felt that Calhoun and Wade Hampton, Governor Wade Hampton, this novelist on the immediate street side of the park to Hampton, cast very long shadows on the children. And she would say, well, how can I tell these fifth graders who John C. Calhoun and Wade Hampton were, and why they stand so high there over our city? How do you look in her eyes? What do you say? How can you convince her that Calhoun is there to encourage her? Do you think it will inspire her to know that story? And when I moved to South Carolina, which is again 40 some odd years ago, I'd say the statue didn't bother me much. We had our statues up in the north. They have their statues down here. I'm here now. I'd have to learn more about these and see what they are. And I've come to understand the feeling of Mrs. Middleton, of Christine, of my children's friends, and really to empathize with it. The one item of disagreement is not over the character of Robert E. Lee, although we could get over talk about that for a long, long time, but is about this idea that the Civil War was not about slavery. It certainly was about slavery. It was about slavery, slavery, and slavery. Stop being about slavery, it was about slavery. And every one of the seceding states, every single one, the only thing the secession proclamations had in common was they were going to defend slavery. You know, states' rights, which was invented much later on, actually states' rights, the southern states complained about the states' rights behavior of the New England states. But I still don't understand why, in fact, people who are sympathetic to the Confederate cause can't own up to that. That's what it was. The Confederacy was on the wrong side of history. It was on the wrong side of humanity, from my point of view. But one thing I think Michael and I do agree on is that inscriptions, plaques, aren't going to make it. That's not what's going to change things. And a few years ago, Dale and I were in Lithuania, and we had an opportunity to visit a place called Ponary Forest, which is outside of Vilna, and it's a place where Jewish people were mowed down by the Nazis and their helpers. And there's a kind of a grove of memorials. There are memorials to Jews, memorials to Poles, memorials to Lithuanians, all kind of in this little kind of section. And one thing we noticed about kind of the memorials is on each one was a plaque. And the plaques had been torn down, new ones put up, torn down, new ones put up. As the kind of political complexion of the country changed, the plaque changed, as if history could be rewritten. And I don't have any confidence in any of the plaques or any of the inscriptions I've heard about. But I think one thing we all agree, that we three agree on, is that what we need are new new memorials, new, not to take down the old ones, but to build new ones. And I agree with Christine, I'd love to see in Marion Square and this is not my proposal, is Robert McDonald here? Robert has written a terrific essay on Charleston's landscape of memorials, and he had proposed a memorial to the victims of white supremacy standing on Marion Square adjacent to the Calhoun Monument and the Holocaust Memorial. And who would that memorialize? Memorialize those people who were brought here on the ships and sold to the to work and to die on the plantations. We politely call them plantations on these slave labor camps. It would memorialize those 4,400, at least 4,400 men, women who were lynched during the Jim Crow era. It would memorialize the Emanuel Nine who were gunned down only two blocks from here. It would memorialize, from my point of view, the 35 co-conspirators of Denmark Vesey who were hanged only several blocks from here. In fact, in the Vesey trial, the trial of Vesey who had organized an abortive uprising in 1822, the court handed out the highest number of death sentences handed out by any court in America until 1948, when the American Military Tribunal handed out 60 death sentences at the Mauthausen death camp in Austria. I would like to see, and I know Robert has mentioned this too, and let me say what I think would be accomplished by this kind of monument. Not only does it give kind of a context of kind of honoring the victims of racism, to me it would help revitalize the Holocaust Memorial. And it does it by placing that memorial. If you look at the memorial where it is now, and it's there it is under also Calhoun and by Wade Hampton, and you're wondering, well, what's its connection to these things? Well, what is its connection? What would its connection be to a memorial for the anonymous African-American people who were, in fact, the victims of oppression? We would be aligning ourselves with the victims of oppression. That's what we want to do. That's what we want to say. And there's a terrific piece, an opinion piece, in the New York Times yesterday by a man named Brent Stables, and he's talking about the new museum, a museum about lynching in Montgomery, Alabama. And absolutely right. And he says that this has now turned Montgomery into the first stop in a tour of civil rights memorials. Well, I hope Charleston can become the second. And I think it's possible. We're going to take questions. Yes.
My name is Neil Gaston. I'm from Minnesota. My great-great-grandfather is from Charleston. He's buried here at Shalom, helped found that synagogue. He was the president during the Civil War. And he's buried at Shalom in Magnolia. Okay.
And he knew my great-great-great-granddaddy. This is his rabbi.
I want to talk about a monument that is missing. It's a South Carolina monument. There is a man buried at Cumming Street Cemetery named Franklin J. Moses. He was a Supreme Court justice in South Carolina after the Civil War.
Governor.
The monument that is missing is the monument for his son, Franklin J. Moses, Jr., who lies buried in an unmarked grave in Massachusetts. When he was head of the legislature here in South Carolina, he brought in public education for freedmen, and when he was governor, he integrated the University of South Carolina. He was run out of the state for doing that, and lies in an unmarked grave. And the question is, I would hope that people here would remember Franklin J. Moses Jr. and find a way to see if they could find a way to memorialize their character.
I would love to speak to him.
Yeah.
Franklin Moses was run out of the state because he was a crook, one of the worst of the carpetbaggers.
What is your proof?
Every historian who ever wrote about him knows it.
No, it's all propaganda by the people who took over the
White House. All right, fine. There were governors during Reconstruction, like Chamberlain, who were not crooks, but Moses was. Now, if you want to build a monument, you take a fund up and build it. But the people of South Carolina aren't going to build it. I agree with everything Christine said, everything. When I spoke to the city council on the monument issue, I said we should have the statues of the Emmanuel Nine right on Marion Square, on the other side of Calhoun from the Holocaust Memorial. And Rodin did it for the burghers of Calais, and there's no reason we can't have statues of nine people. And my group has subscribed to contribute money to that statue. And I want to see it as quickly as possible. Governor, Senator Smalls, a outstanding African-American during Reconstruction, should have a statue at the Battery. Denmark Vesey's statue should not be hidden in a grove in the back of Hampton Park, but should also be at a prominent place. I'm in favor of putting monuments to black South Carolinian citizens of outstanding character and accomplishment all over the state. So Christine and I and Ted agree, don't tear down the statues to my ancestors, build statues to the ancestors of the other half of the population. I want to honor my ancestors, and they have a right to honor theirs. And so this should be the project of South Carolina for the next several decades, to build the statues to the heroes of the African-American community. And if you want to see the best statue, the best memorial in this state, you go to the State House grounds in Columbia, and on the left side is the monument to the African-American people of South Carolina. It is the finest monument I've ever seen, not a word on it. It's all done in bas relief, and it's tremendously inspiring. It begins in the bottom of the slave ship, and it ends with a black South Carolinian doctor who went to the moon. It's magnificent. But we should have those all over the place. Now the problem is the Washington Light Infantry owns Marion Square. It's not public property. And I made this suggestion to the city council in the presence of the president of the Washington Light Infantry, and he says we don't want any more monuments there. So he has to be convinced that's where the Emmanuel Nine statue should be. So we're in total agreement. I just don't want the statues of my ancestors molested. Leave them alone, and we will be of great help in trying to build these new statues to the black population of this state.
Christine.
I'd just like to say one other thing. We're talking about stones and mortar and letters to be printed on iron and so forth. The issue really is here is the hearts of the people. If hearts don't change, nothing else will. We can put all the statues out there that we want, but until people come together through the heart, nothing, the statues won't matter. They're just material out there for us to learn from. And I know it's a start, but truly hearts have to change. And you say, Michael, leave your people's statues alone, but this is not your people's country. It's our country, it's everybody's country. You know, because I meet so many people, and the way I grew up with not baggage of hate. I was born three generations after the Civil War. I'm 62 years old. I wasn't raised with hate. And during the time that I grew up, during Jim Crow in the 60s, blacks were being lynched and people were being found. I was listening to the other panel and I could relate to much of what they were all saying. Hearts have to change before anything else changes. Because you see, as black people in this country, we are still enslaved. We are not free. We are not free. The 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution still binds us as black people in this country. We are still tied to the loophole in the 13th Amendment. That's the Constitution. That's a constitutional change. Just like slavery. Slavery was a constitutional change. The continuation of slavery started after the first slavery ended. December 1865 is when that 13th Amendment was ratified. Hearts have to change before laws can change. And that's really what we have to deal with first. So when hearts open, then monuments and plaques and all will easily go up and be in areas where they should, so we can all learn the whole story of American history. There are beautiful churches, all these beautiful churches in downtown Charleston. There's only one that has taken up the reins to honor the black people that built it. And that is the Unitarian Church on Archdale. They have put a monument in the churchyard that speaks to the people of African descent that built the church and made the bricks to build that church. And I look around at all these big, beautiful churches, and I know where they all came from. There's a lot that needs to happen, but it's got to start with the heart. Thank you.
One more question? The lady in the back.
Okay, we have two more. Let me start in the back, yeah. Armand, you're next.
My question is about the actual meaning of slavery. I know that in 1865, slavery was outlawed in some sense, and I agree that African Americans have been slaves in one way or another since. But there's a book I read a few years ago called Slavery in All But Names that shows how any black person anywhere in the South could be picked up for a bit of loitering, taken to jail, unable to pay jail funds, and put into prison, the prison, say, in Alabama, of the steel industry. People worked in farms and factories in the South until President Roosevelt, faced with a war on the basis of freedom, had it discontinued because the Southern senators kept it going. So my question is, when are we going to refine or redefine what slavery actually means so that it incorporates what's going on today as well as what went on in the South until 1940?
Does anybody want to talk to that?
I think, Ellen.
I can say
something. Okay. We have a respondent.
I marched with Dr. King in Chicago, and I was at a debate with James Farmer, if you remember him, a great civil rights figure. And he was debating with William Buckley, who was a close friend of mine. And Buckley said, "You can't change hearts by changing laws." And Farmer, in his deep, booming voice and great wisdom, said, "Yes, you can. If you have people sitting next to black people on the bus, if they are, by law, forced to drink from the same fountain if they want water, and sit next to them at a counter, and go to the same stores with them, and rub shoulders with them daily, they will find that the sky hasn't fallen. And the integration of the South doesn't mean the end of the South. It means the liberation, not only of black, but of white people, from all of this absurd separation, which cost us so much money to have two of this and two of that, and also it's cost us so much in moral character." Farmer said, "Change the laws, and then you change the heart." Because people who have this intimate connection now with the bodies of black people find it's not the end of the world. So I would say, yes, hearts have to change, but I would also like to see more, for I go to I'm a professor of religion, I go to synagogues, churches, etc. And I go to St. Stephen's Church. It's the only really integrated church in this city. It's one reason I go there. You have not only black clergy invited to speak, but black people and white people sitting next to each other. This is the kind of thing that all the churches should encourage. And it's a synagogue. I used to sit next to Reuben Greenberg when he was a member of Synagogue Emmanuel. He taught me how to shoot. He hurt my ears in those shooting galleries. But he's a great guy. And I believe that a certain amount of love, we had to pass all these. I don't agree with Christine that blacks are enslaved and we haven't made progress. Then what was Dr. King's work about? What was James Farmer's work about? The tremendous changes for black people in my lifetime, and certainly since slavery. There's a lot of racism out there, but the racist knows that the law is against him, and that when the Voting Rights Act was passed, that made all the difference. And the pressure Dr. King brought on Lyndon Johnson to do that, I won't discount that and say blacks are still enslaved. They are not. There are a lot of injustices, but we've made enormous progress, and great figures like Farmer and Dr. King and Lyndon Johnson have to be remembered for giving us that progress.
Michael, thank you. Christine, thank you, and all of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we'll see you in just a couple more minutes for our keynote lecture.